got Brian Forster here with me. Hi, Brian.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. We've got plenty to talk about, I reckon. And you're living in Peru, aren't you now?
Yeah, that's right. I officially moved last June.
And where were you before that? What was it that took you to live in there?
I've been studying Native American or indigenous cultures all of my life, and so I spent a number of years in Canada, where I grew up studying the Native Haida people and others. I got involved in sculpture and carving, and then when I was in my mid-30s, I decided to go to Hawaii because of an interest in Polynesia, and I lived there for 2 years and helped build a 62-foot-long double-hull sailing voyaging canoe bound for Tahiti. After a number of years of that interest, for some reason, Peru just appeared in my conscious mind, and 6 years ago is when I first went to Peru to start exploring the Inca people.
Oh, that's fantastic. So where do you live there? What sort of place do you live in?
It's a little town south of Lima, which is the capital, about 4 hours. It's called Paracas, and that happens to be basically the one place in the world where these elongated skulls that I'm studying are found in profusion.
Yeah, and the elongated skulls, as we'll find out, are specifically here connected with the Inca, aren't they?
Yeah, it's the story's becoming bigger. It's actually a global phenomenon in history. David Hatcher Childress and I published a book in February about the fact that this did occur in antiquity around the world. But for some reason, the Paracas and Peru area has more of them still being found to this day than anywhere else on Earth.
And there are larger skulls there than there are elsewhere, aren't there?
They seem to be the largest human skulls of Homo sapiens that ever existed.
And we say they're Homo sapiens, but on your videos you show that there's actual structural differences between some of these skulls and others of them.
Yeah, that's very true. The book that David and I wrote is about cranial deformation, which is a ritual practice done by different cultures around the world. But what I'm finding the more I research it is that I'm able to start to tell now the difference between ones that have been ritually bound from childhood and where the shape of the skull has been altered to those which seem to be naturally not only larger than the average human, but also more complex and very much a conehead-like shape.
If it is done, it has to be done when the child's young, doesn't it, when the bones are still soft?
Yeah, it starts, I think, probably at about 6 months, and it's a very gradual process that would have taken years once the calcification of the skull is complete, probably at 3 or maybe 4 years old. Then the skull will maintain the shape that you've caused it to take.
So that would happen entirely, actually, then in the child's younger years.
Exactly, probably from 6 months to 3 years, or 6 months to 4 years.
Which only gives you really so much time. There's only so much elasticity in the head, presumably. There's only a limit to how much deformation you can get in such a short space of time, especially being as the kid would still be growing.
Well, exactly. And the thing is that since this was such a ritual practice, you know, some people think that it was torture, but probably not. It was probably done so gradually and carefully, because this was only done to the nobility, the children of the nobility. So they would hardly be torturing their children's, you know, bodies to achieve this shape.
What do we think they were trying to achieve here?
Well, globally, the phenomenon seems to be, when you read about the different cultures, that these shapes of skulls were to mimic what the ancestors looked like, supposedly naturally. Some ancestors in ancient times had that skull shape.
Okay, and some of the skulls, I mean, we as humans, we've got a kind of single plate at the front and then two parietal plates at the back.
Exactly, there are many plates in the skull, but the main ones is there's a frontal plate, which is where your forehead is, and then two parietal ones, which are on top, heading back. And so the three of them join together in an almost T formation. But in a number of the skulls, especially in Paracas, they only have one frontal and one parietal.
And, I mean, given that I mean, most of what defines a given species is its bone structure and stuff. Doesn't that actually make them a different species from us? Because that's a pretty significant difference.
That is, but there are a number of other factors. I've also recently found out that the Paracas skulls are 60% heavier and denser than the average human being of the time, and that there are other features such as two small holes in the back of the head, which seem to be where, they're called foramen, and that is where nerves and blood supply seemingly come out to feed this shape. So that kind of tells us that nature or evolution provided that, and that it goes against the idea that the skulls were bound artificially.
Yeah, that reminds me of some of Lloyd Pye's stuff, because of course he points out that one of the things that distinguishes our the races that were here before us is that they're much, much heavier boned.
Uh-huh. Well, luckily I'm working with Lloyd. I'm providing samples from the skulls to him so that he can do carbon-14 and DNA analysis. And by that, the carbon-14 will tell us how old the skull is, and the DNA will give us, from the blueprint, will let us find out eventually where the different bloodlines came from that that made up these people who, the Paracas, for example, the last individuals died at least 2,000 years ago, so there are no direct descendants of them.
Right. DNA testing, obviously, that's being undertaken now, is it?
Yeah, actually, phase one is, but the samples that I provided about a year ago weren't as good as they could be. I do have excellent samples now, and so basically level two of testing will start. The geneticist is volunteering his time. He's the same geneticist who has been involved with the Starchild skull, and so I think we'll get results reasonably quickly. You know, a year is a long time. I'm hoping within a month or two we'll get at least an idea of who these people were and what their ancestry is.
And some of these skulls have actually got, they've got hair and bits of skin still attached to them.
They do. That's the wonderful thing about the climate around the Paracas areas. It's such desert that we've found skulls, or skulls have been found, that are basically mummified, and you can still see the facial features. What's intriguing is that a number of these noble elongated skulls have red hair, and it's not red as in carrot-colored or Irish or Scottish red. It's a very reddish auburn, and experts that I've shown it to have said that it's a natural color, because some people have, you know, would say, well, the hair's oxidized. But that's the thing, is that Native American people have black hair, and these are distinctly a auburn red. Again, that's a phenomenon that we find amongst nobility in antiquity around the world.
That's interesting as well. That's is anybody doing any research into that?
As far as I know, it's me.
Right. Because I remember Stan Gooch, when he was doing his research into Neanderthal many years ago, he suggested that they had red hair as well. So, and what about your samples for this? Are the standard national museums happy to hand over their skulls for you to scrape for bits and bobs, or are you having to look elsewhere?
Well, I'm very fortunate in the fact that the skulls that we have been found by local people, farmers and that sort of person. There is a black market on elongated skulls, and they can reach, or they can get $1,000 to $1,200 if they're able to export them out of Peru, but it's strictly illegal to sell ancient body parts, thank God, as well as pre-Columbian anything. So what they do is, for a small amount of money, they let us have them. So we have a substantial collection of them, and that's what's important to me, is I want the Paracas artifacts, including the remains of the people, to stay in the area so that eventually, once our testing is done, we can reinter them and hopefully put their, you know, if there any of the spirits are angry with anything, that will put them to rest.
It is important to keep, because this is still, in a way, an ancient culture, isn't it? There's a lot of respect still for the skulls of dead people in that part of the world.
Well, not as much as you would think. In places like New Zealand and Hawaii, the bones of the ancestors are very sacred, because it's believed to some degree that the spirit still resides. Mm-hmm. But since the Paracas died 2,000 years ago, any people who live in the area are not directly descended from them. So they're thought of as just being an ancient lost race of people. And because of Catholicism, anything native or ancient is not regarded as being significant to them. But it is, it is to me and others that I work with.
Yeah, I was thinking of the, there's still quite a significant, what we might call a skull cult, that's not exactly the word I'd like to use, but hopefully people will know what I mean, in La Paz in Bolivia, isn't there? I gather that even the police have got skulls downstairs that they go and ask questions of.
Well, that's true. That there's an interesting mix that still exists in many South American countries where you have a blend of Catholicism with the ancient native belief systems, and that shows up in Mexico, for example, with the Day of the Dead, which is practiced, as far as I know, throughout Latin America, including Peru. That is a phenomenon or a spiritual practice which very much is much earlier than Catholicism, but it was a way that native people were able to maintain their tradition while adhering to Catholicism. It's a mix of the two systems together.
Which has been a trick that native peoples have played wherever Catholicism has gone.
Right.
I think. So to go back to the elongated skulls, you say that they're all over the world, and we mean China. Where else have they been found?
Well, in Egypt, supposedly during the Amarna period, as in King Tutankhamun and Akhenaten and Nefertiti, but also in Iraq, Melanesia, parts of Africa, Russia, Germany, amongst the Olmec. That's why David and I wrote this book. It was a way of identifying where in the world this phenomenon occurred and what possible ties there could be in history between these different cultures.
Because we're suggesting that the Paracas, if they died out, say, a couple of thousand years ago, that's a long time after Egypt arose. When did this practice sort of die out?
Well, the last of the elongated skulls that we know of as a practice was in the 20th century in both Melanesia and also in the Congo of Africa. And what we've been able to find out is that the people of the Congo are actually related to, or their ancestors come from Sudan, and the Sudanese ancestors come from Egypt. And in Melanesia, it's a practice only in the area of Vanuatu in Melanesia. And archaeologists say that those people came down through Asia, on boats or whatever, and wound up where it is they are now. But their oral traditions say that their ancestors as well came from Egypt, and that they left through the Red Sea and wound up where they are.
So that seems that there might be a pattern to the kind of the dissipation of this habit, and it sounds like it ended up in quite local places. Although it's all over the world, that it ended up in quite small areas of given countries.
Exactly, it was a practice again solely amongst the nobility. And the area around Paracas, for example, the population would have been extensive. The majority of the people, at least in the tens of thousands, if not possibly hundreds of thousands, but this very small group of people who had the elongated skulls and the red hair were the overseers of the greater population. They may very well be related to the Inca as well, and also to the people who lived in the area of Tiwanaku, close to Lake Titicaca.
And do these people, because I know certain strains of Maya teaching suggest that they believe that their ancestors were from somewhere other than Earth. And perhaps is it possible that those beings did exist in the past, and that what we're looking at is an imitation of them?
That is possible. That's why, again, the carbon-14 and DNA testing will become critical to attempt to begin answering that question. There are oral traditions amongst the Maya, major connections with the Pleiades star system, which of course, or at least the Pleiades area of the sky, which is That's found all over the world. In Hawaii, for example, some of the shamanic people claim that their ancestors came from the Pleiades. It also happened in North America, Indonesia, and the Greeks, as far as I know. And the common theme seems to be the story of the seven sisters, that seven sisters came down from the heavens and dwelt amongst mankind, and six of them, at least in some stories, six of them returned back to where they came from. One stayed, and she became basically the grandmother of at least one branch of humanity.
And these, there's a version of that myth, more or less, or story, more or less, planet-wide, isn't there?
Yeah.
And is it fair to suggest that, you know, if we've got something that's that old and that far-reaching, that it may, we may well work on the idea that it arose from a single source?
That could very well be. And, you know, what's intriguing about the Starchild skull, even though academics have trashed Lloyd Pye for years, he's a very intelligent man, very dedicated and serious with what he's doing, and he's identified at least 35 characteristics, physical characteristics on that skull, which are clearly not Homo sapiens and possibly not human. One obvious example is the fact that the material that the skull is made of is not the same calcium carbonate that our skull is. It's more like dental enamel, but that's only one of many characteristics. Lloyd is intrigued with the elongated skulls, but we're at a very early stage right now in terms of trying to figure out their ancestry. And again, that'll take carbon-14 and DNA.
Because in terms of looks, that, you know, just outward appearances, there seem to be similarities between the more extreme of the elongated skulls and the Star Child skull. And I was also struck by, again, in one of your videos, because you've got many videos up on YouTube. I'll try and put the links in later when I can get back online. But they, one of them, if I remember rightly, looks like the skull of a child, but has actually got fairly mature molar teeth in it.
Yeah, that's the latest one that I saw. Photographs of that went around the world, I think, in November. It's in a tiny museum about an hour's drive outside of Cusco, which is was the capital of the Inca. And it's the strangest one I've seen, because the... if you look at the skull is very large. It's not simply that the shape has been altered. The volume of the cranium is clearly larger than normal. It's very thin, so what that tells us is that, at least in a normal human, that child would be about 2 years old, because the plates are starting to close on the top, and that's what you see. You still see an opening, but it's the teeth, which appear to be the teeth of a teenager. So that that example within itself is why I definitely need doctors, anatomists, and dentists to look at the photographs and videos I and others have taken and simply tell us what it is that they see, since they are experts in those fields.
Because that really does look strange, the such teeth in such a tiny head. The other thing is that they've got these really huge eye sockets, haven't they?
Oh, they do. The eye sockets are probably, on average, about 20% larger, I think, than a normal human. They're very big. There are a number of other characteristics as well, that they have huge jaws, and many of them, those that reached adulthood, they seem to be lacking molar teeth. Not that they had bad dental hygiene or that they had a bad diet. There are simply no pockets or holes where certain molars are supposed to be. But again, there are many other characteristics that I've been writing about.
These are all pretty substantial differences between these skulls and the skulls of a what we might call a normal or an average human. And I find it difficult to imagine that. I mean, I know evolution is supposed to change things slowly over time, but these are pretty fundamental changes to have been making.
Well, definitely, and the fact that they, at least in the case of the Paracas, we have no idea when they first appeared in the area. I've been able to shatter what's been the theory going on since 1928, which is that they came from the highlands of Peru and established themselves on the coast, because some German scientists wrote a report 2 years ago, where they were actually studying the Nazca people, who lived close by, the place famous for the Nazca Lines. And they were able to figure out that the Nazca, and fortunately they took samples of Paracas DNA as well, that there's no genetic relationship between the highlands of Peru and these coastal people. So that infers that at least some of the genetic content of the Paracas people doesn't even come from South America, possibly. They may have, their ancestors may have come across the Pacific.
That's interesting as well. It seems that there are basically a whole stream of sort of non sequiturs, really, between what we believe our history to be and these actual skulls. The other thing that's interesting is that some of the ones that, as you say, appear to be naturally elongated, shall we say, rather than physically deformed, have got considerably higher volumes to contain the brain.
Yeah, on average, what I've been able to find out is the Paracas skulls, and the thing is we've had to find a contemporary skull to compare it with, because if you simply compare them one against another, you can't tell, and you can't compare with a modern human necessarily. But we do have one skull which is of an Inca period person, so that living in the area. So that person lived probably about 600 years ago. And is normal in any way you can look at it. That skull is average and very similar to what we have, and that's about 1.2 liters of cranial volume. The average Paracas is about 1.5, so that's 25% larger. Yeah. Some people have speculated that the whole thing is due to cranial deformation, and therefore there had to be some kind of air pocket inside the cranium because, the brain would be normal and then the extra space would be made up by air. But what I've been able to do with taking a flashlight and shining it inside is you can see the impressions of where the brain would be in contact more or less with the interior, and it's consistently throughout. So their brains filled that volume.
And we wouldn't necessarily assume the brain would grow just because we were increasing the space for it. And the bigger ones, that's the average kind of elongated skull, isn't it? The bigger ones can be up to twice the size of...
Well, I haven't been able to go that far. And there's a lot of speculation on the internet that they're, monstrously huge. The largest I've seen, I would guess maybe 1.8 liters, but again, I'm doing this as a scientist, and so people can wildly speculate on the internet and write articles about anything, but if they can't back up what they're saying with actual hard evidence, then I personally don't tend to follow those people.
No, I guess it has to be that way. Especially being as now we appear to be entering an era when we can actually find out more stuff that we can be sure of, because up until the relatively recent past we've had to speculate, because without genetic analysis and with only, we've still only got pretty shaky ways of measuring how old things are, but all of those things are improving. Is carbon-14 still the best way of dating these things?
Carbon-14 is luckily a simple way, and so that's why we're doing that first. Because carbon-14, as far as I know, dates from the 1940s. So it's had 60 or 70 years of giving us a good approximation, and that's all that I'm looking for right now. As funding increases, as interest from open-minded scientists increases, then we'll be able to get more detailed and specific. But at least carbon-14 will give us a good basic idea for now.
And I'm finding there are scientists who are willing to at least talk with you privately about this.
Well, it's growing. Luckily, I have I have the support of in my work, not necessarily in the skull area, but in looking for evidence of lost civilizations from people such as Graham Hancock, who allows me to write articles on his website. Christopher Dunn, the brilliant engineer who wrote a great book called The Giza Power Plant, and another one which is Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. Another researcher, Stephen Mailer. And actually, I'm fortunate in that I'm developing contacts with quite famous researchers that many of you would have heard of. But along with that, in the future, I would like to get doctors, open-minded doctors, and anatomists who will not only come and look at these skulls, but will allow me to use their name and some of their quotes.
Because, of course, there is still, even in this so-called enlightened time, a considerable danger of wrecking your career if you put your voice on the wrong side of the argument, isn't there?
Oh, definitely. I'm amazed at how widespread that is. Mm. I can understand that, you know, that someone has to defend their livelihood and their social position. But, you know, I'm doing this in a gradual process. I'm not looking for, you know, instant results. And so as the weeks pass by and months pass by, I'm getting more and more support from not only not necessarily academia, but, you know, scientists, medical people. And what's more important to me is that the general public get to hear about the results and what is being done by me and others, and have them make up their own minds as to what they think is happening.
I think that's really helpful, because I think it's rightly said that if we're going to have any idea of where we are and where we're going, then we need to have a clearer vision of where we might have been.
Exactly.
So we're talking about, in the same place, we're talking about some elongated skulls that appear to be at least 2,000 years old. They're in the area where the Inca were based. But the Inca, they're fairly recent, aren't they? They're sort of beginning of the first millennium, halfway through the first millennium that they turned up. Is that right?
Well, that's the conventional story. And I started, you know, my first book, A Brief History of the Incas, is about the basic academic story of the Inca. They, in conventional terms, they came from the Lake Titicaca area about 950 AD, and they were forced out because of a major climate change, and so they moved north to what is now Cusco and established Cusco as a city about 1100 AD. And then the Spanish arrived in 1532, and by 1533, the Inca civilization collapsed. So they had 300 or 400 years of existence in the Cusco Sacred Valley area to do all that they accomplished, which was phenomenal, because by the time the Spanish arrived, the Inca civilization extended from Colombia in the north to the middle of Chile in the south, the Pacific Ocean in the west, and into the Amazon in the east, and involved probably 15 million people. So it was the largest civilization in pre-contact or pre-Columbian Americas.
And yet there weren't that many of them.
No, that's the whole thing, is that the Inca themselves were solely the royal family, which was a small group of people, at the maximum maybe 1,000, taking care of the affairs of, as I said, up to 15 million. But the more that I'm researching, the more it definitely seems that Cusco itself as a city pre-existed the Inca by several thousand years. And it's my contention that when the Inca traveled north from Lake Titicaca, they encountered megalithic ruins along their path, along this road that existed before they did, and that once they reached the city of Cusco, which they made their capital, they found an ancient city several thousand years old in ruins, and because they were in such awe of the megalithic structures they found, they thought that they should build their capital there as well.
And Cusco is extremely spectacular in terms of its ancient architecture, isn't it? Can you talk us through because you identify in your videos effectively three layers of building, some of which is obviously Spanish. The rest of it, you say local guides just put down everything to be in the Inca, and you're not sure that that's correct, are you?
No, I think there were two major civilizations that existed before the Inca, and both were megalithic. There was one who built these polygonal-shaped walls and structures, some of them with massive stones being up to 125 tons. And we've measured the stones. Some researchers throw numbers out like 400 tons or whatever, but I make sure that I measure the stones, know the density of the stone and the type of stone, so that, you know, I can give at least a ballpark guess of the size. And then there was another culture that was equally as sophisticated, but their building technology was very different. It was very cube-like, much more like what you see, for example, at the Great Pyramid in Egypt, is these beautiful 90-degree angle blocks fitting together so that you can't fit a human hair in between.
Like the central ceremonial area. I can't remember what you call it in Cusco, the one that's built out of really tight-fitting blocks. What's it called?
Oh, the Coricancha?
That's it.
Yeah. The Coricancha is the ultimate example of it's the finest made structure, I think, in all of the Americas.
And it's still upright and in line, despite the fact that in the time it's been there, it must have experienced earthquakes.
Well, that's the great story, actually, is that as soon as the Spanish under Pizarro arrived in Cusco in 1533, the first thing he did is that he ordered his men to go and destroy the Sun Temple, which was in the Coricancha, and then they built this monstrous church, the Church of Santo Domingo, over top of it. But in 1950, there was a massive earthquake in Cusco, and much of the church fell down, exposing for the first time in about 500 years what is the Coricancha, because the Spanish had painted over the stone and painted patterns in pictures and put stucco over top, so that no one knew that there was this Inca or pre-Inca structure. Luckily, the fathers and mothers of Cusco insisted that the church not rebuild, and so that's why we have the Coricancha.
That's fantastic, then. I didn't realize that. It was actually all that fantastic stonework you show, which is really awesome, isn't it? It was completely disappeared.
Yeah, it was painted white, and all the cracks were filled in with stucco, so it looked like a homogeneous wall.
Yeah.
But it's after the church fell down on top of it, and none of the stones of the Coricancha moved. It moved as a single unit.
Yeah, that is astonishing, isn't it? That those, and you seem to establish pretty surely to me that that's done actually using only maybe a couple of mil of difference between one stone and the stone next to it.
Well, literally there are places of like lengths of wall more than 100 feet long and 15 feet high, where you can't fit a human hair in between them. And the stone itself is intriguing because it comes from, it's basalt, and it comes from a quarry 50 kilometers away. So when the standard stories say that the Inca built that building first, you have to question, why would they go to all that trouble to go 50 kilometers for a specific building stone, and where did they get the technology and ability to shape blocks so perfectly like that?
To move them.
And
basalt is one of the hardest rocks to work, isn't it? And yet the Olmecs preferred basalt. The Inca used more than just that, though, didn't they? They used andesite as well.
Yes, and granite.
And granite, another hard rock.
Right.
So they're choosing, and the andesite came from tens of kilometers away as well.
Yeah, andesite is actually what the bedrock is, but there are quarries up to 20 kilometers from Cusco where this special green building stone was brought from.
And one of the things that struck me about that, about the one that was buried with the church, is it really reminded me of the stonework at Luxor in Egypt. I know you've not been there yet, but have you seen pictures of that?
Yeah, it looks very similar. The Coricancha is kind of unique in that the walls are very flat. Most of the other buildings that I suspect in Cusco that are pre-Inca have very angular walls, clearly built, I would think, for earthquake proofing, but the exterior is also this very pillowy, puffy kind of look. They're very three-dimensional.
Yeah.
The Coricancha is almost perfectly straight.
So we're talking about Sacsayhuaman there, the citadel above.
Exactly.
Which has got much, much bigger stones in it, but not so. And they are actually to say that they're just not so regular, are they? They're just as finely worked.
Yeah, well, there it, again, that's, I suspect that was the first building style by these master builders. And not, you know, the conventional story is that the local Inca would find a stone and then roughly shape it and then put it into place. And that's why every stone is different in shape. But if you look carefully, what you see is that they're actual pictograms, in that animal figures are put into it. So the head of a puma is one stone, and then the rest of the body is made up of other stones. They also did this interlocking mechanism in order to probably earthquake-proof, and possibly for resonance or vibrational reasons, they wanted everything to fit super tight together. And if the shape, such as Sacsayhuaman, is so complicated like that, they definitely had their reasoning behind it. And the precision, again, is often you can't fit a human hair in between these monstrous blocks.
And it's also, it almost looks like the really big irregular blocks that are, like you say, kind of pillowy and still perfectly finished. It's almost like the principles were established on a giant scale there. And then once they realized that, you know, giving their blocks several angles so that one was sitting so that it couldn't push left and another so that it couldn't push right, it looks like they kind of realized that that worked well and that they could do it then on a much smaller, finer, more artistic scale.
That could very well be. Actually, the interesting thing about the Coricancho, even though the stones appear to be perfect cubes fitted together, if you look along the horizontal lines, you'll notice that they're not straight lines. They actually go in waves. One man has explained to me that the reason for that, again, is earthquake proofing, in that since earthquakes operate in a wave form, having straight lines is dangerous. And so you want the earthquake wave to run through the horizontal regions in order to not destabilize the buildings. But there are little tiny raised areas at the ends where they interlock with each other, and that seems to be a mechanism, and we're talking just two or maybe 5 millimeters, but that means that the one row can't move back and forth on top of the other because it gets caught almost like by a nail catching it, left or right. And that's a pattern I just recently found in my second to last trip to Cusco.
Because like you say, if that was going to shift, if they were going to move just a little bit to the left or right, they'd have to lift the entire weight of the wall that's on top of them.
Exactly.
So we effectively have these kind of cyclopean, incredibly finely crafted blocks that are not only crafted individually, but also the wall itself's beautifully shaped and curved at the ends. And then we get what we presume are actual genuine Inca buildings, which follow a kind of similar pattern, but the rocks don't fit together so well. And they don't keep such a level bond.
Right. Well, they're varying styles, and it's not to detract or remove anything from the genius of the Inca. It's just they had copper chisels and stone hammers. That's what's been found in the archaeological record. So it isn't a question that the Inca couldn't do it. No one with those tools could do that fine a work, and that's the same argument given in Egypt, is that the same type of tools are found, and yet when you look at something like the Great Pyramid, you see the craftsmanship is very high, you know, seemingly very high tech, or at least such a fine degree of workmanship in super hard stone. And that's where some people will argue and say, well, the great cathedrals of Europe, you know, they're perfect craftsmanship. But the thing is, as far as I know, they're mainly made of limestone, and limestone's very soft. Granite is very hard, andesite's very hard, and basalt are much harder materials to work with.
And these are the stones that the ancients liked to work. I mean, the same was true in Sumer. They were working with basalt and diorite, and they just didn't seem to want to make their job particularly easy.
Well, you know, from what it seems is that was simply their level of technology. They knew how to do this. And probably it was in some ways simple for them. Other people speculate that the reason why the super hard stone was used was because they wanted permanence of the structure. Whether or not they wanted it, you know, them to last so that we could see them, I don't know. But the function of these structures was clearly beyond simply being temples or places of worship. Some of them may have actually been factories or some kind of functioning structure whereby super hardness was important. Integrity of the construction was very important. And possibly because andesite and granite have a lot of quartz crystal in them, that there was something about the resonance, something based upon the vibration and electrical properties that was incorporated into whatever the function it was that these things did.
Yeah, there's one site that you go to in your videos, I'm not sure where it is, where the inside of the place appears to be glazed. I can't remember what the word is that you use, but
it's vitrification.
Vitrification, yeah, indeed. What do you reckon was happening in there? Because that's a very special looking place.
Yeah, there are actually other ones as well. There are some exterior walls that look like that, and I've taken two engineers so far, one from England and one from the United States there, in the last few months, and asked them, what do you think this is? And they both agreed it looks like some kind of amazing heat treatment, but neither have had any explanation as to why or how it was achieved.
No, I haven't seen pictures yet. I did go looking for them. There are rumors of castle foundations in Scotland in the UK that also have that vitrification on them, like they received an incredibly hot blast of some sort. But I thought it wasn't just the fact that it reflected your watch that was impressive. The actual patina, the smoothness of those stones in that place was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And I do have a very dear friend in Canada who's a descendant of the very ancient line of knowledge from Scotland and England, what people call Wicca or whatever, but it's much deeper than that. And he said that the stone towers in Scotland and Ireland that are attributed to the Celtic people are actually much older. Yeah. You know, that England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales have phenomenal history, which is only starting to be looked at. And that's why I love the fact that I'm here, because I'm going to very much look forward to looking at Stonehenge and other places with my knowledge of Peru and see if I can see any similarities at all.
It'd be very interesting because, I mean, Stonehenge, for example, also is built out of very hard stone. The people who are presumed to have built it are assumed only to have had not even metal. They're assumed to have been using antlers and basically animal tools, and yet they're incredibly shaped. They're fluted so that they kind of make a given sight line through them, and of course they've got the mortise and tenons on them. So you've not only got to be able to lift those trilithons into place, but they're going to slot on top of a peg. So it strikes me as being similar but different, the kind of architecture over here. So we're saying that really, and I think it's quite clear from when I first saw pictures of Machu Picchu, you can see up there as well that you've got kind of Cyclopean architecture on the bottom, really big solid stones, with smaller stones fitted together in a similar kind of pattern. But what we're saying is that there's some people who we've effectively lost sight of. Maybe the people with the elongated skulls, we can't be sure, but there's some people we lost sight of who were there at least some thousands of years before the Inca.
Well, definitely. And Machu Picchu, for example, there are three what are called temples now. One is the Intihuatana, which is the hitching post of the sun, which is the most famous place there. There's also the Sun Temple, and there's also the Temple of the Condor, and they appear to me to be several thousand years older. And what also seems to be a phenomenon is that, again, it's possible that these ancient structures didn't have necessarily a religious function, but had some practical function. But it's because of the residual energy left there and the fact that there's so much quartz and, in some cases, iron content that later people would adopt them as religious structures. So it's very possible that the first construction or function was completely different to that which has been attributed by academics, because everything in Cusco is called a temple, which is kind of silly.
It's same the world over, though, isn't it? Mostly they find artifacts. They don't know what their actual purpose was, so they describe the meaning as possibly ritual, possibly religious. I'm thinking of a place, I can't remember the name of it, somewhere between south and north Iran, there is a place that would have got flooded by a huge dam they made up there, but it didn't kind of quite make it. Just looked like a piece of desert that they've now dug into. And in this place, they've found, like a church, it's a building of some sort, and underneath the floor, they've found lots of different size pits. But actually, some of them are big enough to get several humans in. and they're connected together. Some of them are connected, others aren't, by little runnels and things. And I just looked at it and I thought, well, it looks like some kind of industrial process. It looks like you're trying to pour something in and let some stuff run off the top, mm-hmm. so that, you know, you maybe you're after the stuff that's running off the top, maybe you're after the stuff that's left in the pit. But again, it was put down just as a temple, as a religious center, and we won't really know. But that thought effectively takes me to Tiwanaku, which is where you say you think that these people might originally have come from.
Mm-hmm.
And that place is full of things that look industrial.
Very much so. And what most people who have been there or who have read about it, they've heard of Tiwanaku and they've also heard of Pumapunku as being two distinct places because they look quite different. But I think what happened was that I think they're two different time periods. I think Pumapunku was the first era of construction, because we can find Pumapunku style stone around the Tiwanaku complex as if it was recycled by the later Tiwanaku builders. And then after that, we have the Aymara people who are the present population. They've been, you know, present population being 1,000 years. But then they started to extract a lot of the stone to make their own buildings, and then the Spanish came, and unfortunately much of Pumapunku, probably only 5% of what was Pumapunku, is left. But I can see at least three different ages of humanity existing in that area, and I think Pumapunku is the oldest. And like we've seen in many, in some parts of the world, it's the most refined craftsmanship. It literally, you take a steel ruler and put it up against one of these stones, and you can't see light coming through it.
Some of them are big flat surfaces, aren't they? I was particularly, there's one or two really, really big, very, very flat things that you show.
Yeah, there's one that's 131 tons.
Yeah. I'm struck by the fact that in Tiwanaku everything looks like it's been scattered randomly over the surface of the earth, like it's been kind of thrown over by an earthquake or something. Is that genuinely the way it appears, or have things been dug up and left lying on the surface?
No, that's the intriguing thing, is that it's, you know, Tiwanaku is this barren, you know, Tiwanaku / Pumapunku is this barren plain 11 kilometers from the southern end of Lake Titicaca. And if you visit there, you'll see that a lot of the stones, some of them quite massive, are tilting all in the same direction, as if something came and struck it, like a massive wall of mud came and ran right through it and then went downhill into Lake Titicaca. And so in any of the excavations, and unfortunately less than 2% of the area has been excavated, but any of the test pits they've done, you can see these beautifully precision blocks sticking out of the ground, you know, at least a couple of feet under the ground.
That was going to be my next question, is I, as an amateur kind of researcher through books rather than through going out and seeing this stuff, it is my impression that there is not a lot of archaeology being done in some of the places where I'd most like to see it.
Tiwanaku
is obviously one of those.
Well, and unfortunately they've been doing, some people did a very bad reconstruction job at Tiwanaku, because what you see these, you know, very nice big walls and things, but that was done in the 1960s by archaeologists, and they basically pilfered from other sites and rebuilt these walls that didn't necessarily previously exist, because I have 19th century photographs. And what it shows of Tiwanaku is a series of standing stones. And then all this, you know, so-called rubble lying all over the place.
You've got kind of like a huge standing stone rectangle.
Exactly. Yeah, if you look at detailed photographs, what you'll see is you'll see every approximately 15 to 20 feet a standing stone, much like you would see in England, heavily eroded, and then in between they filled them in with walls. So to the untrained eye, you can't tell, but once you see one example, that's what you'll start to see. So we don't know what Tiwanaku originally looked like, but what it looks like now is not what it originally looked like.
And there's I remember one of the, I mean, it's very difficult with Zachariah Sitchin stuff. There's a lot of good material in there and a lot of it that's now thought to be unreliable. But one of the most amazing pages he had was a picture of things that looked to me like they came from a press shop. you know, things that are full of right angles, full of parallel lines. And he just drawn, they were drawings in his, but then when I got to see Gary's talk a couple of years ago and then your website, I see that they are actually pictures of things that are found in stone, hugely accurately engineered and all different.
Yeah, that's the astonishing thing, is that there are 90 perfect, you know, because we took right angle squares there in November when we were filming Ancient Aliens, and we're talking perfect 90-degree angles, not 89 degrees, not 91, 90 degrees. I mean, the square locks into place. The most intriguing thing for most people are what are called the H-blocks, of which there are a series of. And the thing is that they have these, you know, these cube-like impressions in them, but what Christopher Dunn has found out is that they're not actually just 90 degrees. They're more than that. So these are actually dovetail joints on a massive scale.
So that is like something that's designed to hold something else in place.
Yeah, to lock something in place, yeah.
I wonder what happened to all the other stuff.
Well, a lot of it is in the nearby village of called Tiwanaku. They built the church out of the stones of Tiwanaku and Pumapunku. A number of people's houses have Tiwanaku and Pumapunku stone in the walls. And then many of the most oldest of the colonial buildings in La Paz, the capital, again, was taken from Tiwanaku because it was a lot easier to simply deconstruct the buildings there than to go mining your own or quarry your own stone somewhere else.
And how close is Tiwanaku to Cusco?
Tiwanaku to Cusco is, by car in modern times, it's about 7 hours. But there's a lot of evidence that 10,000 years ago, Titicaca was a much bigger lake because we can see the floodplain to this very day. And the water levels of that lake are very dynamic. It's quite possible that the lake was much larger. And so travelers wanting to go in ancient times from Tiwanaku to Cusco, they could simply travel from the south end of the lake to the north end of the lake, and then the actual terrestrial amount they would have to travel would have been reduced substantially.
I see. So as we acknowledge, moving around on water is a lot easier than moving around on land.
Well, exactly. And there are sacred sites around Lake Titicaca, which are above the lake now, but they're right at the point where they would all basically be beachfront 10,000 years ago.
I hear that there's evidence of quite large sort of almost seagoing style vessels or docks on Titicaca. Is that right?
Some people have speculated that that's the case. It's possible, but I think that that Pumapunku was more the Pumapunku period, which preceded the Tiwanaku period, even though some Tiwanaku structures, I think, are as old as Pumapunku, but again, were recycled and altered, that it was some kind of metal ore processing plant. Because the Andes are, you know, you are right in the Andes. The Andes are full of gold and copper and silver and other metals. And you need a lot of water to do the processing of ore. In ancient times, they diverted a river which naturally should have flowed into Titicaca and steered it straight towards Tiwanaku. So that's what David Childress and I speculate it was initially some kind of processing plant. And then when its function ceased, like any mine would or a lot of factories today, whoever built it to that high precision because it was required for manufacturing simply abandoned it. And then it was later adopted by somebody else.
So we're basically looking at an ancient culture whose name we don't know, and we don't even really know when they were there or what they were doing.
No, and even the names are the problem because Pumapunku is a Quechua word, which is Inca, and puma is a large cat, like a cougar, and punku means gate, so it's the gate of the puma. But why it's called that, I don't know. There are no pumas carved anywhere there, really. And then Tiwanaku is an Aymara language, word from the Aymara people. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but it's also known as Tiahuanaco, and that, again, is a Quechua word. So the problem is that, you know, people put labels on these places or names on these places, and we don't know what the original names were. We don't know who the original people were, but that's the ongoing, that's why the research keeps going.
It'd be nice to see more digging now, wouldn't it?
Oh, definitely.
It really would.
Definitely.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've gone for nearly an hour and 10 minutes. I'll play a couple of tunes, and then perhaps we can have a chat about Easter Island, because that's another place that particularly interests me, and I know you've spent a bit of time there.
Certainly, that'd be my pleasure.
I'm hoping to move on now to Easter Island, which is another place where an enormous amount of carving and dragging around went on once again, but I think, Brian, by people that we don't know who they were.
We have actually a pretty good idea of who built carved the giant moai, the heads that people see in pictures on Easter Island. But again, there are different ages of them. So the vast majority were made by descendants or ancestors of the resident population, but there are possibly much older ones as well. It's a very mysterious place. I spent a week there in February. It's a very intriguing story of human history.
What sort of resident population is there now?
Right now there are about 3,000 to 4,000 native Rapa Nui people.
Oh, wicked. And how are they supporting themselves out there?
A lot of it is tourism and to some degree commercial fishing. It's technically part of Chile. So there is a Chilean sort of footprint there as well in terms of population of people. But what I'm most happy about is that the Rapa Nui people are very resilient. They've been through absolute hell since first contact with the Europeans in 1722, but they're very strong and very still, very much warm-hearted Polynesians.
So they managed to keep pretty much their domestic culture intact through this?
Well, that's what's astonishing, is that because of, again, European contact and waves of different countries taking their island over, disease, slavery, etc., in the 1860s, their population had dwindled down from probably 5,000 or more people to 111 individuals.
That's all that was left.
Yeah. And so now their population has risen back up to, I think, 3,000 to 4,000 people there, and another 3,000 people living around the world who are of Rapa Nui ancestry.
And they're living in towns?
Yeah, there's one town called Hangaroa, which is near where the airport is. That's where most people live. But it's amazing that they still have their dances, their oral traditions, their language, their carving and other art styles are incredibly vibrant.
So what does their oral culture tell us about the history of these figures and the islands?
Well, the most interesting thing I found out is that, again, conventional scholarship says that the Polynesian people began in Southeast Asia, traveled down through Indonesia, and then across to Tonga and Samoa, arrived in Tahiti, and then spread out from Tahiti north to Hawaii, southeast to Rapa Nui, also known as Easter Island, and New Zealand, which the Maori people call Aotearoa. But the oral traditions of the Rapa Nui is that they are the first Polynesian people. So their bloodlines come not simply from Southeast Asia, but also probably from the west coast of South America and possibly other places.
I have read that these islands were populated against the trade winds rather than with them.
Well, it's actually very simple to sail with any kind of sailing craft from the west coast of Peru to Rapa Nui, depending upon, you know, it varies from year to year, but I just finished writing a book called Crimson Horizon about following the tradition of the people and also how it would be possible for them to sail from the west coast of Peru, and it's not really that difficult. And Thor Heyerdahl more or less proved that with his Kon-Tiki in 1947. He didn't try to steer a course, but he left the port of Callao, which is at Lima, and after 101 days, I think it was, he wound up in Polynesia, farther north than Easter Island, but still, if he had been able to properly, or if he tried to properly steer his vessel, he probably could have steered it to Easter Island.
Yeah, yeah. He was bewitched by the place as well, wasn't he?
Oh, very much so. And it was his contention that an ancient race of red-haired, light-skinned people were quite possibly the first inhabitants, and that the Polynesian people were a second wave of migration. And he was vehemently attacked by that, or by academics for that theory, but I think there is credence in it. The only thing is, the mysterious thing is, who were these red-haired people? They weren't Irish or Scottish people, I don't think, but it's because we find the red-haired phenomenon, more auburn-colored hair again, on the west coast of Peru, and also find it throughout Polynesia, that I think there's a definite genetic bloodline carrying through all of these people in deep antiquity.
Yeah. So do we know how long the people have been on the island?
Well, their oral traditions are very cryptic. Conventional scholarship says that the first people arrived there probably about the 10th century AD. But the local informants I have, who are members of native people who live there and oral tradition experts, they said their great founder, who was called Hotumatua, arrived about the time of Christ, about the year 0, or 100 AD, 100 BC, but then in a hushed voice they say he was a latecomer. So what they're saying is that Rapa Nui has been inhabited for a very long period of time, much longer than what conventional archaeologists say is the case.
And that seems to me to be a reasonable argument, because once again, if we talk a little bit about how those giant stone heads were actually carved and then removed in situ and then removed from the ground, we realise that once again we're dealing with the people that had some sort of skills that we don't have now. Can you just outline how, because they didn't actually carve the blocks out and then carve them into faces, did they?
No, the majority of the stone, and the thing is, they're not stone faces. What's intriguing is that they are full bodies. What you see in the pictures is you see this neck and head sticking out of the ground, but there are more than 200 of them at the location of the quarry where the entire body is buried. So rather than being 10 or 12 feet high, these are 30 or 40 feet high.
And they're kind of carved horizontally while still in the ground, aren't they?
Yeah, they were. The thing is that the quarry is one massive volcanic stone, and so they were carved out. They were squared off. The top would have been carved, the sides would have been carved, and then the underside would have been gently carved out, much like the some of the structures in Egypt were done. And then once that block was released, they would raise it up on its feet, and with a series of pulleys and ropes, they would literally have them walk down the hill, these massive stone blocks, and then they would be dropped into pits where the finishing work could be done. And it's probably the result of a major local problem that happened, that that site was abandoned, and so fill, naturally over time, dirt and things would fill the holes in, and that's why they're up to their necks.
Oh, I see. So they were originally left with the holes. I mean, actually thinking about it, it's a volcanic island, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would have assumed as a landscaper that you'd have a bit of difficulty digging pits big enough to put...
Well, that's true. I mean, they were, with the limited technology they had, they were, great engineers of their time. The stone itself is very soft, so it wouldn't be that difficult to carve, but... Again, these are multi-ton in size, and what's most intriguing is Dr. Robert Schock, who is well known as the man who dated the Sphinx in Egypt at being pre-dynastic, or, he says 7,000 to 8,000 years old, well, whereas others would say possibly, 12 or 15,000. But he was on Rapa Nui, Easter Island, 2 years ago, and he noticed that some of these Moai human sculptures are carved from basalt. And so he walked around the island looking, as a geologist, for the quarry, and he couldn't find it. He actually suspects that the quarry might be underwater. So these basalt moai may be the oldest, and they may have been carved before the end of the Ice Age, when global ocean levels were 350 feet lower than they are today.
So we lose a whole load of stuff in that. because a lot of these places, the older occupations are actually down at the sea level, aren't they?
Exactly. Well, most cultures would have a tendency of living by the ocean because the oceans were highways, contrary to conventional thought. And so at the time that the Ice Age ended, probably the majority of people of the Earth would have lived along coastlines or along rivers that emptied into the ocean. And then over the course of less than 1,000 years, as far as I know, ocean levels rose globally by 350 feet. So the majority of ancient civilizations and their structures are now underwater, as Graham Hancock would tell you, as a result of several years of his research.
Yeah, and I mean, we know from the way civilizations develop, I mean, the Olmec did it to a certain extent, that they do occupy the riverine settlements first. And then as you get the more complicated things arising, they move up the hill until eventually they chop the top of the hill and put ceremonial places on top of it. So all the way around, I often think of Malta. I mean, Malta is such an amazing place. What we have got of it above water, there must be loads of it that got buried, drowned in that particular rising of the sea.
Oh, that's true. And that's why people say that these, you know, cart tracks seem to, like, go off cliffs or enter the ocean. It's because they continue. It's just that the ocean level has risen. What's intriguing about Malta, and takes us back actually to our first beginning of our conversation, is that that's where hundreds of elongated skulls were found.
Yeah, now I was surprised by that. Mm-hmm. And are there any of the real big ones, like at Paracas?
Well, unfortunately, none of them are on display. They've been taken out of display, and that seems to be another global phenomenon, is that it's very difficult to find the elongated skulls because the museums that have them in their collections don't display them, and unless you're an academic with credentials, you're not allowed into the warehouses to look at them.
Mm. So these ones in Malta were on display and then were at some stage removed.
That's what I've heard, yeah. Like at least, I believe, 300 of them were available to look at, and now there are none.
And that's a lot.
Yeah.
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 And also, I mean, we think that the heads on Easter Island are also show signs of this elongation.
Well, that's actually, yeah, you can, artistically they look that way, and also again by talking to local people, when I got into my conversations about the auburn red hair, of which there is still a high population or percentage of people with that, including the nephew of this one lady informant of mine who I saw walking down the street. I said I'd just written a book about elongated skulls, and that's what I was studying in Paracas, Peru. And she said, well, in ancient times, we had people like that too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So they're another fine stoneworking people. Just as a matter of interest, how many are made out of basalt as opposed to the softer rock that presumably they were left with once the seawaters had risen?
I think it's only about 11 of them. It's a very tiny number. There are about 950 moai on the island. Some have been taken. Some of them, of the oldest ones, are smaller and have been taken away. And coincidentally, the finest example is in the British Museum.
Oh right.
So the British Museum has one which the Rapa Nui people allege was stolen from them, and they would very much like to have it back.
Yes, yes indeed. Yeah. Thor Heyerdahl's work there, he came to the sort of standard or established conclusion that whatever went on there ended in a war and stopped happening because they ran out of trees. You, I gather, don't think that that's necessarily the case.
No, that's what's good about the local informants I have. I've read a lot of the literature, and it's all archaeology, a lot of it is theoretical as to what happened. There were two people, two different races of people who lived there. One were called the Long Ears, and one were called the Short Ears. The Long Ears had long ears, and all of the Moai had these long distended earlobes, which coincidentally was also an Inca practice. And again, that's where I'm finding a connection between Peru and Easter Island. But then there are also the short-eared people. The Long Ears were supposedly the ruling people, nobility. They had lighter skin. Some had black hair, some had red hair, some had blonde hair. Whereas the short ears were all what we think of as Polynesian people. And Roggeveen, who was the very first European to land there, he's the one who gave the name Easter Island to the island. It was his description that said that. He saw very tall people, almost giant, you know, giant-like, or at least very tall people. And many of them seemed to have light skin, red hair, and blonde hair.
And this is, again, I mean, this is something that commonly comes up in creation myths and myths of origin, isn't it? Is pale-skinned, red-haired, or blonde-haired people appearing in Reed Boat with books.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's interesting. Again, I didn't know that there was that mixture of hair colors on these islands either.
Yeah, what's amazing is that there's still a population there that has, you know, that has that, and it's not from European contact, because they call it Kehu, and I asked my lady informant about her nephew, because he has this reddish auburn hair, and she said no, I think it's the Tiku family. They're all red-haired like that. I said, are they mixed? And she said, no, that's a very ancient thing.
Right.
And to a great extent, they don't like going into great detail, because what they expect you to do is listen to what they have to say, and then they give you gems of wisdom, and then if you want to learn more, you have to go back. So for me to learn more, I'll have to go back and spend more time. But I was just in shock that I saw this. And also, when I lived on Hawaii, they have the same phenomenon called Ehu, because it's the Rapa Nui language and the Hawaiian language, Tahitian and Maori, are all the same family of languages. But the same phenomenon. You see a Hawaiian with reddish, rusty, auburn hair, and somebody says, oh yeah, that's from the first migration of people.
And is anybody examining the genetic background of these people?
Not that I know of. Mm. Yeah.
Another of those things that one can't help thinking that maybe they don't want to look into.
That could be.
And is there a shamanic basis to this island life?
Very much so. It's very... The real shamanic work that still exists is very quiet. You'll get people who will conduct ceremonies and, you know, be involved in the tourist business and things, but that has nothing to do with the real, you know, the real Polynesian sacred knowledge is very much alive, very much kept sacred and safe by the practitioners, and it's only through direct active involvement that you get glimpses. And because I was involved in this Polynesian or Hawaiian canoe-making project, which was for the people of Hawaii, I was allowed glimpses into the culture that tourists and even residents don't get to see. And it's not that I'm special, it's just that that's what happens when you get involved with native people, is that once they begin to trust you and you see that you're actually doing something constructive for and with them, that, you know, it's like any family. They naturally want to start to tell you things about who they are, where they come from, and they want you to be part of some of the practices, because they want, you know, they want your involvement, they want you included as a member of the extended family.
Because you didn't only do the canoe building, you started off doing totem poles, didn't you?
Yeah, I did as a kid when I was growing up in Canada.
Were you taught how to do that by people to whom it was a native skill?
Exactly. And that was quite strange initially, because, you know, I was blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and I used to go and watch them carving, and they would just look at me and, you know, not pay attention. But eventually I was so persistent that they just observing that they started to include me in, and they started teaching me mainly my mistakes. I would carve something, take it to them, and they'd say, well, no, that's not really how you do it. And then they would show me. And looking back, I'm very, you know, very grateful. It was very strange to be a white boy or a white, you know, white person wanting to get involved, but it was because of the integrity of the people and because of the oral tradition that I fell in love with, that I've been given these opportunities all of my life.
Yeah, it reminds me of a Maya saying, because I've done some work with Mayan elders over here rather than over there, and they say to be Maya is not the color of your skin, it is a state of mind.
Exactly, and what many Native people say is that, you know, we don't care what you look like, we're reading your heart, and we're reading your intent. And that's, you know, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Explains why some people don't gain easy access to shamanic knowledge, I guess.
Well, very much so, and there's been so much prostitution of sacred shamanic knowledge and profit making by, you know, quote-unquote white shamans who are stealing cultural practices that, of course, these, you know, these true shamans are going to be very shy to outsiders coming in.
And a lot of them, of course, did suffer really heavily at the hands of the Spanish and various other European invaders. You can't blame them for being a bit secretive about it.
Well, that's true, and that's why most of the sacred knowledge is still kept, because it's gone underground. And whenever people would ask, you know, do you still practice these things, they would say, no, we're Christians. Yeah. But since it's an integral part of their being, of course these practices still exist and do continue. It's just that it's not in the open because of so many decades or centuries of persecution.
Mm. One of the things I really remember about Thor Heyerdahl's book is a trip he took over a cliff into a cave where he said that that many artifacts were stored by these peoples. Did you see any of that stuff?
The museum there, they have a little museum on Rapa Nui, but it's very poor, and that's because the majority of artifacts are in foreign museums. For example, their written language, which is the only Polynesian hieroglyphic language called Rongo Rongo, they don't have any examples whatsoever. The vast majority were burned by missionaries, and the 25 pieces that still exist are in foreign museums. So they would very much like to have those back. But the most intriguing thing, though, is that academics have tried for 200 years to decode Rongo Rongo with zero success. And I learned when I was there that the native people still know how to read it, but it's just they're not going to tell me what it says.
Oh, that's really cracking, because of course that takes us to another interesting subject, really, in that there isn't very much writing in that part of the world, and in ancient South America, I don't think there was any.
Actually, that's another fallacy which I recently have been able to uncover. The Inca had two written languages. And actually originally three, but there was one High Inca before the Spanish arrived that was a little paranoid, I think, about the general public learning to read, because the Inca royal family were, I wouldn't say control freaks, but they wanted all information contained, and so he banned an early form of written language. But then there's another hieroglyphic system, which if you look on the internet and you see paintings of the Inca, you'll see these square patterns of symbols on their clothing, and that is the language.
Okay, I had heard that, in fact, that quite complex histories are encoded in what look to me to be geometric patterns.
Yeah.
But it is, in fact, a form of writing.
It is. It's a syllabic language, so okay. Each symbol represents a syllable. They also have the quipu system, which is knotted cords for accounting. But Dr. Gary Urton from Harvard University, who is probably the world expert on the subject, he's starting to think that it's actually, as well as being accounting, it's also binary code, and that transposes into language. So again, the Inca controlling of their knowledge, they converted letters into numbers so that only certain individuals could ever read it.
That is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's amazing. And effectively, they were writing on fabric only. Did they do any of the sort of bark skin books or animal skins?
No, actually, the quipus are a series of knotted, it's like a string with vertical knotted cords.
Yeah.
So that way, that makes it very easy to store and very easy to transport, because you can basically clump it up into a ball, stick it in your pocket, and carry all of that knowledge with you. And it's very made out of very tough wool fiber, so it'll last a long time, whereas the problem with bark is you have to, you know, fold it. You can't really fold it or whatever. So the quipu system is very transportable.
And did they manage to keep I mean, are there ancient examples of Quipu about? Because, of course, the Spanish destroyed nearly everything the Maya ever wrote, and they wrote everything down.
Yeah, well, the Spanish destroyed a lot of... They destroyed the Quipus that they found in sacred buildings, but the Inca were so prolific in writing that you can actually buy Quipus. Tourists can buy Quipus in the markets in Cusco still. So there are a lot of them. And fortunately, the Peruvian government has millions of artifacts. So if anyone is able to get access, which I'm sure they probably could, to the collection of Quipus, then the wealth of knowledge there is probably still phenomenal.
I was struck last week, I heard it mentioned on an interview that you did, but also Q mentioned last week a bowl that was discovered, I gather, in the 1960s, around Lima, was it? This bowl that's got an unknown language written on it from Cusco, but also has got Sumerian cuneiform on it.
Yeah, that's actually found very close to Tiwanaku, at the south end of Lake Titicaca. It's called the Fuente Magna bowl, and there's also a statue carved out of stone that was found with it, and they have cuneiform writing on it.
That's, I would have thought, an exceptionally important discovery.
Well, it points to possible connections with the Middle East.
Do we know which cuneiform it is? Because, of course, that was a script that was used by several, although it was apparently invented by the Sumerians, who were using it to basically to use a language that doesn't appear to be related to any on Earth, but then it was kind of inherited and used by the Assyrians and the Akkadians afterwards. Do mm-hmm. we know how old the Sumerian on this bowl is?
I personally don't. David Hatcher Childress wrote a very good article in the World Explorers Club magazine, I think two issues ago, about it. And so it had.
See a copy of that.
Yeah, well, actually, you can find it online through Wex. I think it's called WexClub.com. There are great pictures in that, and actually, you just have to put through Bing Images or Google Images Fuente Magna Bowl, okay, and you'll see some good pictures of the cuneiform on it.
Because, of course, that was, in a way, it reminds me of a real breakthrough they made when, I think it was Cyrus the Great also, who was mentioned last week, who had three different sets of script carved something like 1,400 foot up on a several thousand foot rock face. And one of them was Old Sumerian, and the others, which we didn't recognize, and the others were recognized scripts of some sort. And the Sumerians effectively came out of the shadows with the translation of that last piece. I think that eventually parallel translations were done under sealed cover to make sure that everybody was getting it right. And they also found the same three languages on a vase, which was used as a test translation. But up until the point where somebody managed to translate that last piece of script, we didn't even know the Sumerians existed. So I'm really fascinated to find that there's some over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it is, it's traditional amongst archaeologists to stick to the idea that there has been no contact between these various races.
Yeah, and this clearly is, it's not a fake or forgery. People have a tendency, even with the elongated skulls, to say, well, you got Hollywood to make them or something. You have to realize these are developing countries. And somebody who finds an artifact like that, they're not going to say, gee, I can make a lot of money out of it. You know, if it's made out of gold, of course, but something like the Fuente Magna Bowl or the skulls or whatever, there are millions upon millions of artifacts in Peru and Bolivia. And in fact, Peru and Bolivia are one huge archaeological site, so finding artifacts is simple. So obviously things like this and many other intriguing things are authentic. It's just we're very blessed now to have the internet that we can communicate in, you know, so easily like this, but we can also exchange videos and photographs globally with one another so that we can be the researchers as a human family rather than waiting for the experts or the governments to do things. We're just doing it. It's fun.
A, it's fun, and B, it doesn't look like they're going to do the work anyway.
Well, that's true.
isn't it right that the word Inca itself has a Sumerian meaning?
Well, that's intriguing. I don't know that much of Zachariah Sitchin's work, but I think there's a character called Enki.
There is.
Okay, and Enki was either a great warrior or a god. Inca means child of the sun, and their name for the sun was Inti, so it's very close to Enki, and that's something that I'm starting to look at, and is fascinating, is looking at words from one part. You know, when you find an artifact, it's interesting to see if there are any words whatsoever in the modern language, like even one that relates to that. And I'm finding that to be the case between the Rapa Nui language and the Quechua language of the Inca, is that there are certain words which mean the same thing, and they're off by one letter. So that could simply be something based on the linguistical or the accent or something, like a T instead of a P.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Or a little bit over time as it changes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So we've still got lots and lots of stuff to discover over there.
Oh, yeah.
And your next plan is to, I believe you're planning a trip to Egypt now.
I'm doing a number of tours in Peru and Bolivia this year, including with Christopher Dunn, you know, author of the Giza Power Plant, in August.
Looking forward to reading that myself.
Well, it'll be great because Chris is bringing all of his, you know, instruments with him to measure. So you know, what happens is that the tours I do aren't tourist tours. They're actual explorations that people get to come along on. And in the case of Chris, it's quite a serious but fun look at the ancient technologies that the Inca and others may have had. And Chris will be gathering evidence as we go, which people can witness.
And, of course, he's got a fair amount of knowledge of Egyptian technologies, which means you'll be looking for common points.
Exactly, especially things like core drilling, evidence of machine marks on hard stone, that
which
sort of thing.
Something we didn't mention in connection with those the pre-Inca buildings is that they have got some pretty interesting holes drilled through them without spirals. I love the picture you've got on one of your vids of a man shining a torch down what's basically, it looks to be a sort of 2-inch hole.
Uh-huh.
And what you can see is a series of concentric rings rather than a spiral.
Well, that and also these score marks that seem to go down as if the tool has caught some kind of material and pulls it as it goes.
Yeah.
I've had the two engineers so far look at that, and they're just completely, which is fun, they're completely bewildered by it.
Yeah. And that in itself must surely give you a better chance of attracting a few more informed people. If you send a couple of them in the know back and they go, no, honestly, mate, you've got to go and see this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's great. You know,
Engineers are your prime rationalists as well, aren't they?
Oh, very much so, because, you know, what engineers say is that their thoughts and their acts exist in the three-dimensional world, whereas someone like a doctor buries his mistakes. So, you know, engineers have to be very pragmatic. But to take him around these places, it's fun just looking at their faces as they try to figure out how, you know, not necessarily when these things were made, but how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're going to continue looking into what seem to be possibly several races, possibly one race of people who lived some distant time ago and were pulling off incredible stunts one way or the other, more or less over the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And we seem to be getting very close to finding some truths there.
Well, step by step, luckily I heard from Stephen Mailer, who's a researcher, that Egypt is, you know, he's in Egypt right now, and he said Egypt is opening up a lot because of the Arab Spring situation. And so many of the sites that were off limits, he's been able to visit. And that's where, you know, a lot of the evidence is in the stone itself. And if you can see more and more of these places, you get a better picture.
It's interesting, I'm wondering if it's a coincidence that suddenly we're finding ourselves gaining access to Egyptian sites when for ages and ages people weren't willing to issue licenses, and that the Bolivian government is putting on display only now something that it discovered in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they feel the time has come as well.
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's very good for tourism. It's very good for the pride of the people of the country. And I think on a much subtler and deeper level, it's that the ancestors themselves want the information to come out fast so that we get a picture of the fact that we are a complex being that has been sophisticated much longer than the Bible has existed.
Yeah. So it's definitely a matter of watch this space.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't been able to put any links into your material because I haven't got any of the chat boxes or things open, but your website is hiddeninkatours.com.
Yeah.
Which is well worth a look because it's not like you say, it's not just a tour company. It encourages interested people to come out and basically share in the discovery, isn't it?
But exactly.
You've got lots of other projects on there that you're doing, your books that you're writing. Would you like to say a few words about those in the last sort of couple of minutes or so?
Sure. I've written 10 books so far. They're all averaging 100 to 150 pages because they're virtual guides of sites, virtual guides of cultures. You know, my first book, A Brief History of the Incas, is that. It's 130 pages because that's about as much as the average person wants to know, whether they're visiting Peru or would just like a history of that culture. So that's why I don't bother going into depth with, you know, writing volumes because most people aren't going to be concerned about that. But hiddeninkatours.com contains links to all of to my other websites, including hiddeninkavideos.com, which has the best of my videos, and related sites. So that one central website connects you to a lot of different things.
I think you are doing us a favor with the books as well, because whilst there is a lot of material out there about the Maya and the people that surrounded them, finding published information about Cusco in any detail is very difficult.
Well, yeah, there are many books. Most of them are in Spanish, and I write in a style which I think is very readable because I want as many people as possible to experience it. I don't want to be snobby and write it in technical talk.
And a lot of the other books, of course, follow the standard archaeological line, which is looking a bit threadbare nowadays.
Well, the old paradigm is worn out and isn't worth pursuing. So that's why the great thing is that they're also in ebook form, so I can constantly update them with new information and take out old information.
And have they got plenty of pictures in them?
Yeah, they do. Especially my book about Machu Picchu, which is literally a virtual guide. It takes you step by step as you walk along the paths and up the staircases. It points out buildings and structures to you that the average tour guide won't show you, and that shows you the megalithic. It shows you that Machu Picchu was begun several thousand years ago, most of it built by the Inca, but it's a much older series of structures.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you very much, Brian.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to hearing you talk this weekend.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Because we are, of course, here on the eve of the Eternal Knowledge Festival in Suffolk.
Yeah.
Anybody that wants to pop on down to that, it's eternal-knowledge.co.uk is the website. I'll be talking here, Brian will be talking, Hugh's down here but not speaking, Greg Sams, who we heard from last week, will be here, and many others besides. As it is, though, it just remains for me to say thank you very much for that. I've really appreciated that. It's a subject that I find endlessly fascinating, and hopefully I'll be able to keep up with you on Skype and see what you're doing in future.
Great.
In the meantime, I'll say goodbye to the folks, and thanks as ever to TNS for providing the space for doing this. Thanks to my great friends at the Scottish Sovereigns on the land.ning.com who led me into all of this in the first place. And thanks, of course, to all of you for being there and listening, because without you, it really wouldn't be worth it.